This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bob Eastemps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about conflict resolution with Samantha Drum, a brilliant attorney based in Indianapolis who can really speak to this through her work, but also has a lot of personal experience dealing with conflict and what she describes as high conflict personalities in the workplace and beyond. So, such a good conversation. We got on really well. And there's a lot here that I'm glad we got to cover because conflict can be a part of so many people's experiences when it comes to mental health, particularly, I think, when it comes to conflict within families and whether it's the high pressure situation that can be or whether it's someone in a courtroom. There's a lot of times when we're going to come across people that we don't agree with and people that want to argue with us and push their own agendas over whatever is good for us and our mental health. Also, I have to mention, we get into a whole new layer when it comes to the bit behind the paywall today, the extended episode for our Apple Podcast subscribers. So often includes these extra reflections that can be the most insightful part of the episode. And this is very much an example of that. So if you wanted to try out a free trial of our Apple Podcast subscription, this might be the one. Now, with that all said, let's get into the episode with Samantha Drum in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, my name is Samantha Drum, and I'm an attorney in the United States. So I have struggled lifelong with anxiety. My whole family on my dad's side, we always joke that we have TNT or tension, nervous tension. And so it has kind of just been something that I struggle with, my dad, my sister, but it never really became too big of an issue in terms of me being able to function or anything until I would say law school. And that's when I really kind of started encountering more difficult people in my life.
Did you mind if we dwell a bit in the family stuff even? Because I think that sounds really interesting that that was so acknowledged.
So actually, I learned that phrase, TNT, from my aunt this summer when my sister was getting married. She was joking about how we all just kind of had this like latent anxiety. We were all like a little bit stressed out. And she was saying, it's that Serrano TNT. My maiden name is Serrano. And so it's that Serrano TNT. And I was like, what's TNT? And she goes, it's tension, nervous tension. And I was like, that explains exactly my experience. Like, I've always had this weird tension and nervousness. Even like when I was little and I would fall asleep, like I couldn't ever stay asleep. I never slept through the night. I would wake up in the middle of the night with heart palpitations. And I always just kind of thought in my head, oh, this is related to like maybe I didn't do a good enough job. And so I convinced myself if I just work harder, I won't feel like this anymore. But it was really just a kind of a physiological thing happening in my brain and in my body that I just couldn't, you know, recognize as a child. Started learning how to kind of manage it better by, you know, kind of putting it into perspective and helping myself reason through the feelings that I had. But I always had the feeling. So I've always just kind of lived with this latent feeling in my chest or in my tummy that just doesn't feel good. And I've just learned kind of how to go about my day accepting that feeling and not allowing it to ruin my day or take over.
Yes. And I think a lot of people will listen and relate to that, that constant feeling that it's really difficult to describe unless you've been there. And yet it sounds like you had some camaraderie in your family, that you were on that sort of same wavelength, should we say? And was that something that was openly acknowledged by all of you, that sort of feeling of tension and stress?
Well, it's funny because like even though we all felt it, we didn't take it out on each other. We had a very happy little family growing up. But like you could definitely tell that my dad, you know, he kind of would like wiggle his legs a lot because, you know, you could tell that he was just kind of nervous and he had a lot of energy that he needed to get out. Or my little sister, who also has it, she always just was very nervous. And if she would have any kind of stimulant like coffee or something, she would like go off the charts with her anxiety. So we always knew that there was just kind of like some underlying like, okay, you know, we have something about us that, like, we're just not normally naturally calm and relaxed people. My mom was very, like, my mom is very even keeled. And so she didn't really experience that. But she did know how to kind of like manage us well. Mm-hmm. And she could recognize my thing would be I would just clean everything. Because it was like one of the things I felt like I could control. So I couldn't control my feelings, but I could control my environment. And so my mom would always be like, hey, Sam, you're cleaning a lot. What's going on? And then I could talk about it. And that really helped. It was nice that we were able to kind of narrow in and like identify what was going on. And then my mom was really good at helping me work through and talk about it.
Oh, that's so lovely. Yeah, that's quite a skill to be able to recognize that and approach that conversation so delicately. And so it sounds like there was a lot of tools you were able to put in place quite organically to manage this as you grew up.
Yes. Well, so as I grew up, you know, I learned a lot about how to just express to my mom how I was feeling or talk to my sister, my dad. I learned how to, you know, talk about it and just say, you know, this is what I'm feeling. And a lot of times we would talk about, okay, well, is it founded in something? Is there like an actual reason you're feeling this way? Or is it just there? And that's something that as I grew up and I ended up meeting my husband, we would do the same thing where I would, you know, if I could tell that something was wrong and I just knew that I was having a problem, I would tell my husband, look, I am having horrible anxiety right now. I just feel dread in the pit of my stomach. And then he would ask me, okay, well, is something causing it or do you just feel it? And so it was very helpful being able to determine, is there something that we could work through together or mm-hmm. is it something that I just have to kind of sit through and learn how to manage as best I can? And one of the tools that I use a lot in managing it is breathing exercises.
This is great. The fact that you're able to pick up so many of these tools, which like many of them are taught in cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, so mm-hmm. these are things that people study in order to teach each other, essentially, as therapists. And it sounds like you found your way to them in an organic way. And so talk me through the breathing.
So there are two breathing mechanisms that I use. One of them is called box breathing, where you breathe in for 4 seconds, you pause for 4 seconds, you breathe out for 4 seconds and pause. And so that one has been very helpful. But my favorite one that I like to do is I breathe in, you know, basically as big as my belly can get. So I breathe in as big as my belly can get. And then I exhale for as long as I can handle it. So I know that some people like to be like, oh, breathe in for 4 seconds and then breathe out for 8 seconds, make it like twice as long. For me, that was too like stringent. And I just needed something where I just needed my body to just naturally feel like, okay, I have enough breath in my belly. Now I could just let it out as slowly as possible. And that really helps me to learn how to regulate my body. Mm-hmm. So I learned that from a chiropractor.
That's great, because I think that's such a misunderstanding people have around anxiety, is thinking that you're not trying to control it or address it. You know, if people don't get it, or even you yourself can recognize there's not always a clear rationale relating how you're feeling to the situation, that is something you're aware of. And with time, mm-hmm. you only become more aware of and often more frustrated by. And so, yeah, I agree that sometimes the tools can feel a bit too stressful, even being like, okay, so I need to breathe, but also there's 7 steps and all these time measurements. And that feels like just something else to stress about and feel that you're doing wrong. And yeah, so no, that sounds a really good way of connecting back to your body. And box breathing is one that I often recommend to people because of the visual element, that you can focus on mm-hmm. a square in a room and use that to trace around each side, and each side is an in-breath or an out. You know, and that can be enough distraction to take you away from the racing thoughts without them being another thing to have racing thoughts about.
Right.
And so you have a family that is supportive and understanding. You have a husband that really tries to help you out and get into your space and understanding of this. Was there a point where things escalated, or, you know, there were people that you came across that really did the opposite? You're nodding.
Yes. Yes, there is. So when I was in law school, I had 2 lawyer bosses. So in law school, you have to do internships so that you can prepare for becoming a lawyer. And I had 2 bosses who would fit the qualifications of being high conflict personalities. So basically, a high conflict personality is someone who repeatedly escalates conflict, and they almost like receive reward from conflict. And so they don't really have an interest in resolving or coming to any kind of resolution. about what they're upset about. And so that's really stressful because when you can actually come to a resolution, you can figure out what the problem was, and then you guys can each, you know, kind of implement what you're supposed to do to get to a resolution. And these two bosses were not like that. And so while I already had that kind of underlying anxiety, I got to a point where I became physically ill because of my anxiety. There was nothing that I felt like I could do to help myself other than talk to my parents or talk to my husband. But I felt very, very trapped. And it kind of took me down a path of learning, okay, I need to learn how to deal with my anxiety in a better way than just talking about it, because I still feel stuck and I need to learn how to handle discomfort in a way that I'm not ruining my body, because I was ruining my body by allowing it to just seep in and just completely consume me.
Mm-hmm. And so when you say ruining your body, you mean in terms of like the tension and the way it would take over your life?
So tension, I was constantly like this, like my whole body was scrunched up constantly. I could not relax my shoulders. I really had a hard time moving and I was very stiff. But also I ended up developing some serious stomach issues. So my second year of law school, I developed what's called functional dyspepsia, where basically I had some kind of acidic problem in my body, but when they did tests, they couldn't figure out what was actually wrong. So they called it functional because it's like, well, we know you're experiencing the problem, but we don't know what exactly is going on in your body. So I had that. And then eventually I developed autoimmune-like symptoms. So I never actually developed an autoimmune disease, but I developed autoimmune-like symptoms. And basically my body just was kind of breaking down. And then I became gluten and dairy intolerant. I completely had to change my diet. Basically, I just had so much stress going on in my life that I was having a physically hard time functioning as a person.
Mm-hmm. No, I can definitely see that. And we're still at the very early stages, unfortunately, of understanding so many of these mind-body connections that is very common, but is less commonly understood. You know, I think of another parallel being how many people have IBS, where anxiety is either a factor in it or potentially the cause there. And a lot of the theories, as I'm sure you know around this, are to do with how your body is in that perpetual state of stress, how you're holding that, how this fight or flight element's kicking in. And so your body essentially is in panic mode, not knowing what to do, and certain things can shut down. Like, for example, in a fight or flight extreme state, your immune system is one of the things that's suppressed because your body's busy pumping blood to your limbs. So you're ready to run, not focusing on digestion, not focusing on fighting off a flu. It's focusing on this very moment because we're in panic.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. And at the time, was this something you were able to recognize a lot of those links?
Well, I started doing research because when I don't understand what's happening with me, I want to know what's going on.
It's, such a lawyer.
Yeah, I am such a lawyer. So I started doing research and I started learning a lot about psychology and what was going on with stress. And that's when I learned that I had heard fight or flight, but like it didn't resonate with me. There was nothing about it that told me, oh, you need to look at this. I started doing a lot of research into mental health and how, you know, basically what the effect was on my body, because it was, honestly, I didn't even care about fixing the anxiety. I just wanted my body to stop. Like what it felt like betraying me. I felt like I was just being betrayed constantly. And so I just wanted to find a way to resolve that, because a lot of doctors kept saying, you're so stressed. And I was like, well, I don't feel stressed. Yeah. And I think in my mind, I was telling myself, I think I told myself, you're not allowed to be stressed because you're supposed to be strong. Mm-hmm. And so I kept saying, I'm not stressed, because I didn't want to be perceived as weak, because I felt like it would be a credibility issue with my job. And I think I finally had to really just acknowledge, I am stressed. That doesn't make me weak. I need to do something about this stress. And I need to start figuring out how to manage these people who are taking my already stressful life and making it just feel intolerable.
Right. And that's the thing. I chuckled there because, you know, oftentimes when people are told this by medical professionals that you're stressed, the question is, yeah, I know that, what do I do about it? And yet in your situation, it was a case of you struggling to connect to that because you're like, no, I can't be stressed. I've got to keep a level head. That is what's expected in my profession. And yet you were seeing plenty of people in your profession very much being the opposite. And perhaps that's closer to the reality, you know, of dealing with the law. In terms of, before we dig into some of how you navigated these high conflict individuals, what's your understanding of what causes that kind of a personality trait? What drives it?
Yeah, so there's several factors. There's a temperament factor, like what is your natural disposition in your personality? So are you naturally kind of a more explosive person, or are you naturally more of a cold person? So people who tend to be naturally more explosive in their temperament are more likely to go down the road of high conflict, personality-wise. And then there's also a kind of relational component at some point in this person's life. They experience some kind of trauma. So typically it kind of comes down to like an attachment issue where they, you know, someone in their life made them feel not safe. And so they've kind of taken that lack of feeling safe and they kind of just put it on other people. And they kind of blame other people for how they're feeling constantly because they don't want to take responsibility for, well, if I want to feel differently, I need to do something about it. Mm-hmm. So environmental, relational, and then there can even be like physiological where like someone experienced a head injury. And after that, they were never the same. They turned into a total jerk. And so there could be that kind of thing.
The technical term.
Exactly. So professional. But they just turn into a different person. And so, you know, basically there could be an issue with blood flow in the brain. And so it could be any of those factors. It can be a combination of those factors. A lot of times, though, when you're dealing with just like your average, what people consider a narcissist nowadays, it's usually kind of this person is already predisposed to not being a very nice person temperamentally. And then they had some kind of experience in their life where they impose that experience on all of their relationships, and they kind of make it a self-fulfilling prophecy because they've been disappointed, they've been hurt, and so they don't know how to get out of that negative feedback loop. Mm-hmm. And so they just keep making it real in all of their experiences and relationships.
Yeah, I can definitely see that somebody's in a position because of certain things they've been through and certain, yeah, temperamental elements of their personality where there's a defensiveness and their approach to that is to be on the attack constantly, to be ready for conflict and expect it even when you're having a normal conversation with them and there is no conflict. You're asking them a question or you're, you know, querying something in a professional manner and then their response isn't to resolve it. It's, you're questioning me. You're attacking me and I've got to attack
back.
Right.
What do you mean by that? And yeah, it gets very, yeah, they get very defensive. And that's kind of the way they operate is they're basically walking defense mechanisms. They don't know how to handle stress. And so the minute they perceive some kind of stressful situation or perceive a danger to themselves, whether it's like an ego danger or they just don't know what to do about it because there is like kind of a fear of the unknown, defense mechanisms go on immediately. And then that's just how they automatically respond. There's no thinking. There's no kind of evaluating and like stopping and pausing and saying, oh, should I be reacting like this? They're just reaction.
And so what do we do?
So what do you do? Yeah. So I had mentioned to you earlier, I do have some resources available for your listeners. So if they want to, they can go to controlledconfrontation.com/resources. And I have an argument playbook. I have a quiz asking, you know, is this high conflict? If they're wondering if they're in a high conflict relationship, and a smear campaign survival guide in case they find themselves the victim of a smear campaign. But basically, what do you do? For me, what I have realized is the most effective way of handling someone who is in attack mode is, like I said, they are acting off of automatic reactions. So the best thing that you could do is have a like pull back your own automatic reactions, stop yourself, pause, and like think for a minute. Allow yourself time to actually come up with a good way of responding methodically versus having a reaction. Because when you react back to a high conflict personality, what you're doing is you're giving them negative feedback. And so then they keep reacting the way that they were already doing it because they don't feel safe. And you obviously don't feel safe, but your job is to be the safe person in the room and be like, look, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to make this cycle continue on. So pausing is such a huge deal for me. I have a little tool that I call focus.
I want to pause on that actually, because I think that's such a good point that essentially you're creating positive feedback. So your negative reaction is creating positive feedback of, I was right to be on the defense. I knew this person was attacking me because now I've raised my voice, but more importantly, they've raised theirs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Yeah, you're almost validating what they have going on in their mind. I was right to react like this, and I'm justified because of it. And so they don't want to take your responsibility for their behavior. And obviously, you're not reacting like that because you want to be rude. You're just like freaking out because obviously you're like, what is this person's problem? So the tool that I like to use whenever I'm under attack with someone is what I call focus on your feet, where as soon as I realize my body is like, mayday, mayday, this is so scary. Why are they being mean to me? I will immediately focus on my feet and I will like, I'll wiggle my toes. I'll really just kind of make myself be grounded in the sensation of my feet so that I don't start blurting things out that I'm going to regret and I'm going to make the situation worse.
I love that. That's great. I have a similar tool I use sometimes for texting where it's much lower stakes, but the amount of times I will get stressed by sending a message and then immediately wishing I'd rephrased it. And one of the things I found to do there is thinking about it, typing it, closing the app, coming back to it, you know, maybe a few seconds later, but it gives me enough time to catch up on my most logical thinking.
Right. I think that a lot of people fall victim to, when they're under stress, they fall victim to this idea that they need to respond right away. They need to like take it head on. And that's not true. And that's probably not the best way to handle things. And so giving yourself permission to say, I don't need to say or do anything right now. I can walk away. I can say, I'm feeling overwhelmed right now. I need to table this issue right now. And we can talk about it when I feel like I'm in a better spot. Because what you're doing is you're limiting their behavior, but you're also setting a boundary for yourself on, I'm not going to violate my values just because this person is basically putting me in a position where I could.
Yeah, no, very true. And amongst all that, you're slowing it down, you know, particularly if it's like a written communication, you're providing a boundary there of just, we're not going to get into this right now because we don't need to. You know, and hearing you talk about these high conflict personalities, my understanding of it is, as much as we can frame it as a group of people, there's also such situational elements. And there's a lot that you can unlearn as the person escalating a lot of this conflict in the first place. And in your work, what sort of things do you find in terms of general conflict resolution? So often you'll be in situations with people where, because they're dealing with the stress of the law, they can act entirely different in a far more temporary manner.
Right. So I would say that the number one tool that I use with my clients when they're acting in high conflict manners, because they're obviously stressed out. Their case has been going on for several years. They just want to know, when is it going to be over? And so they will call and they're very upset and they're yelling. And so I like to use what's called an EAR statement, which stands for empathy, attention, and respect. And so you empathize with them and you validate, like, I understand this has been going on for a very long time and it's just very stressful. And you can also set realistic expectations with them. I'm going to be honest with you, it's still going to go on for a while because the law works very slow. But you're giving attention to their problem and you're letting them know, I understand where you're coming from and I acknowledge it. But like, there's only so much I can do. But you're also respecting them and saying, like, it does matter to me, your frustration and how you feel about it. This is what I'm going to do for you. And this is what I can do for you. These are my limitations. But basically, I always just acknowledge them, allow them to vent, say, I'm so sorry. I get it. I see where you're coming from. This is what I can do for you to manage their expectation. And this is what I'm going to do. And then I give them a chance to give me feedback on, okay, I also want this. Because sometimes I do want to give some feedback. They want to feel like I get a say in how all of this goes. And so I will tell them, and then I'll ask them, do you want me to follow up with you in a month and let you know how that went? And so basically for me, just acknowledging people where they're at in their frustration and then setting really realistic expectations so that they know how things are going to go in the future. that really helps a lot with tempering high conflict situations in general.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that. And following on from that, what would you recommend in terms of finding the boundary in, I guess, a range of workplaces between empathizing with somebody's stress level or with someone's difficult situation, but not doing so in a way that might encourage that level of anger, let's say? So you want to show that you understand, but also if you have certain limitations, you know, is it helpful to go into, you know, this part of the law also frustrates me? Or is there a part where you need to stay more neutral to not encourage certain frustrations that may not be helpful?
So basically kind of what I do is I have also been in a car accident. So I do personal injury law. So I've also been in a car accident. So I do tell them, like, look, I get it. I've been there with you. I have had to wait it out. It's frustrating. And so I, like, because I'm not allowing them to behave badly by telling them, I understand where you're coming from. Allowing them to behave badly would be to just, like, allow them to just keep yelling at me. Like, if they're to a point where they're, like, just nothing is going to calm them down, then I'm going to say, you know what? You are clearly not in a place where you can have a productive conversation with me. So I'm going to hang up right now. And we can talk about this again later when you can find yourself in a more calm position. So you can limit behavior, absolutely, while still being empathetic. They're not inconsistent with each other.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about getting to that point, because I feel like a lot of people would hear that and be like, I don't know how I would ever speak to somebody in that kind of clear, direct, here's a boundary I'm slamming down right now. Because, you know, I need to, but particularly when dealing with anxiety.
Right. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Let me tell you. I was the biggest people pleaser. I think my family, we're just naturally people pleasing kind of people. We don't like people to be uncomfortable. And so I came very much from a people pleasing background. And as a lawyer, you can't really do that. So that was really, really hard for me to overcome. But I learned that there is a time and a place where you have to be disagreeable. You're not being a jerk. You're not being selfish. You're not being any of these negative connotations that someone could, you know, try to frame on you. You're being disagreeable, saying, I am not willing to agree to being treated like this. I'm not willing to be agreeable to, you know, allowing this to go on. And so I'm going to disagree in a respectful way. And I have to be direct. I cannot just allow this person to walk all over me, because that's not going to serve anyone. It's going to teach them that what they're doing is okay and acceptable. And it's going to teach me that, oh yeah, like, you know, when things get really uncomfortable, I just back down. But you can't live your life that way. And if you are living your life that way, you're suffering the effects of it.
And actually, along those lines, did you find that by the necessity of learning to do this through your work, that then carried over into, oh, now I have the practice at boundaries in the rest of my life?
Yes, yes. Because like I said, I started with two high conflict bosses, and they were the two people who woke me up to these types of personalities. Like, that was the first time I realized, like, oh, these things exist. But once I realized what a high conflict personality was, I started realizing that I had a few in my family that we all just kind of wrote off as like, oh, that person's just, you know, they're just mean. They're just, you know, they're just difficult. And so once I realized that, I had someone in my family who was, you know, basically, for lack of a better way of phrasing it, kind of trying to take over mine and my husband's life with regard to how we raised our children. And that was really uncomfortable, because it kind of got to a point where she had agreed to take care of my kids while I went to work. And then she started outsourcing daycare to a nanny, and I did not agree to that. And it was really uncomfortable to actually go and say, I'm not going to allow this to happen anymore. You can't keep outsourcing my childcare. You know, we had an agreement, and it was really devastating for the person who was the childcare, you know, providing the childcare, because obviously I didn't want them to be out of a job, but they just crossed such a boundary that we were not okay with, that I had to allow myself to be uncomfortable and disagreeable enough to say, this is not okay with me. And I do need to make changes so that I can be okay with how things are going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is such a thing to overcome with the anxiety piece, where you're prioritizing yourself, you know, rather than stepping past where you're connecting to in that. Yes, this situation may make someone uncomfortable. Yes, I don't want to have this conversation. Yes, I'm feeling very anxious about navigating this. But there is an aversion of this where I get to back away. You know, this is something I have to go through, and something as big as who's looking after your child is intensely anxiety provoking, but at the same time, so is having that conversation with this relative.
Right. Well, and I think I had to get to a point where I realized I'm going to experience discomfort either way. I am going to feel discomfort by allowing this to continue on, or I'm going to feel discomfort by addressing it head on. And for me, I kind of had to balance it, like weigh it out and see which one is more important to me. And then, okay, well, then this is the discomfort that I'm going to choose to endure so that I can get the result that I want. And so I think that a lot of people feel like you don't understand. I can't do that because of this factor. And what they don't realize is they're already living through discomfort, and they just decided that that's the discomfort that they're going to live with. But it just, I guess it really comes down to what are your priorities, and are you willing to implement something that is going to allow you to feel discomfort in a different way to achieve a result that you want to achieve? And that's kind of how I had to start learning to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you're up hearing a little story, one of my favorite motivational speakers, Lisa Nichols, talks about this sort of essentially a parable that's been passed on by various people in her industry, where the person in the story each day walks past a house, and every day they see this dog, and the dog is whining, and the owners are sat out on the porch with the dog, and it's just such a confusing situation because the owners are there, the dog is whining, it seems unhappy, probably, possibly in pain, and yet no one's addressing the situation. And the dog keeps whining, and every day, the same thing. And after a while, the protagonist of this story approaches this couple to ask what is wrong with the dog. The dog always seems upset, what's going on? And one of the owners says, well, he's sitting on a nail, and it's uncomfortable enough to whine about, but not uncomfortable enough to move. Essentially, Lisa tells this story in order to highlight how that's the situation a lot of people are in, where they're in discomfort, but for whatever reason, there are things holding them back from taking action on that and resolving it. And I think it's a difficult thing to unpick within a mental health context, because there are many things in our life where we need outside support. We can't move from that nail on our own. But there is also always a part of it that involves our will, you know, whether that is seeking treatment or whether that is, you know, accepting treatment or accepting a diagnosis that may not have been something we went out looking for so actively. And yeah, and this feels like an appropriate place to talk about that, where there are a lot of these situations in our lives where we come across that may be quite long term. Like dealing with a horrible boss, like having a job that we really hate, like dealing with various mental illnesses where it's going to be uncomfortable for a long time. And so what situational elements can we change? Is that something we can do on our own, or is it not? But also there's always that element of our willingness.
Right. So I would say, just reflecting on my personal experience with those bosses, I know that where I was mentally in both of those jobs. With the first job, I knew I needed to get out, because that's when all the health problems started. I knew I needed to get out, but I was really afraid of the consequences of leaving, because my legal community was very small. And the attorney that I worked for was not a kind person. So I was really worried about if there would be backlash if I left. But I finally had to hear a podcast where someone was talking about, you know, this is the United States. If you don't like your job, you need to leave. And I was like, but it's not that simple. But I think it was because I was making it not that simple. And I really just needed that nudge to say, like, no, if you really don't like your job, you're not lacking choices. You're making your choice by staying. You know, there are other choices. Are you willing to make it? And so I finally, like, got up the courage to just be like, okay, I'm going to make a different choice. And, you know, and so I did. And I went into the next high conflict boss. That was a mistake. But I'm proud of myself for getting uncomfortable enough to move on. But with the second high conflict boss, it was even worse, because this boss was the kind of boss who, she was very manipulative. She was very She was always putting people down. You knew that she was going to have a really bad day if she came in complaining about her daughter. You just knew, like, oh, no, just run for your life and hide, because she was prone to, like, throwing things. And she would say, oh, you're so lucky. It used to be so much worse. You have it so good here. And so I really did feel stuck. And I finally got to a point where I was so beside myself. Like, I almost, like, fainted in my car on the way home from a skiing trip with my husband, because I knew I had to go seek her the next day. And like, that was kind of the point where my husband was like, you're about to faint in the car. Like, you're so upset and anxious about this woman. You have to do something different. And so I knew that, like, for me, my parents always taught me, you don't just quit a job without having something lined up. And I did not have anything lined up. And so I kind of had to take a more strategic approach. So my husband kind of did a lot of working with me to act out different ways that I would address the problem. And I didn't know what a boundary really was at the time, or that I was allowed to set boundaries. He just basically told me, this is what you got to do. You got to go in there. You got to go say, you can't yell at me anymore. You have to treat me with respect. You know, I won't put up with this anymore. So he kind of like walked me through it. We did a little exchange where we practice it. And then the next day I went in there and I did it. And so that was like step one. Step one was just going and setting the boundary of, I'm not doing this anymore. You have treated me like this in the past. I'm not going to allow it to go forward. And she was really freaked out, because I don't think anyone had ever done that with her. And she was like, what is this, an ultimatum? I said, no, this is me telling you, you have to treat me with respect, because I didn't want her to fire me either. So like, trying to like walk this really awkward, it kind of felt like a, what is it called? A tightrope. It felt like I was walking a tightrope. And so I went and set the boundary with her. And then I made conscious decisions to try to limit my exposure to her while I looked for a new job. And so unless I had to talk to her or be around her, I was in my office, I was doing my job, and I was making sure that there was no fault that she could find in me. And I was looking for another job. And then eventually I was able to find another job and get out of that situation. But I knew that for me, long-term staying with her was not an option, because it was just so, the environment was very toxic. So basically what I would recommend is, if you're in a situation like that and you don't know how to get out, start by setting a boundary and making it clear. They will push back on the boundary. And so set the, you know, hold your boundary and hold firm. And this is also really good too, because like, from an employment law perspective, you know, write down what you're experiencing, because there could be grounds for some kind of employment harassment lawsuit. So writing down what you're experiencing with someone who is so horrible to you. And then, so once you set your boundary, then start making plans for an exit if you really just can't stand it there. And then while you're stuck there, minimize any opportunities for them to cause havoc for you or create negative feedback loops.
Mm-hmm. I so appreciate that. And I think this really speaks to how, you know, getting off the nail, as I was putting it, it's not easy. And not all of us have the same options. You know, there are often barriers. There are often things we need outside of ourselves, like, you know, you getting the support of your husband, like having another job to give you that option, that way out. And so as much as it can be incredibly difficult, I'm like personally such an advocate for make the options for yourself where you can, or find the help where you can. You know, for example, it doesn't always make sense to people, but if I'm talking to a friend, let's say, or a colleague who really dislikes their job and they don't think there is another one, I'll say job hunt anyway. Because you might find a job you didn't think of, or you might be offered a job you don't want. And even the act of turning down another option can in itself be quite empowering, or can, you know, for some people, maybe that's what they need. They need a reminder of like, oh, actually, this is the best job for me in my industry right now. But, you know, that additional option can still be helpful. And yeah, I'm loving this conversation. I love this kind of stuff. Because, you know, ultimately, my fear for people is this idea of like getting stuck on the nail, of living an uncomfortable life, particularly when certain elements of that discomfort can be resolved.
Right. Well, and I think another thing that you, as you start learning to get uncomfortable, you build what I call distress tolerance. So you learn how to experience distress, and you learn how to tolerate that experience in your body and in your head. And so, like I said, with the first boss, I moved on to the second boss, and that was also horrible. But then I moved on to another job. And like along each way, I built a little bit more tolerance to feeling uncomfortable with these types of people. And so by the time I got to this next job, it was fantastic overall, except for one attorney who was basically pawning all of his work off on me. And I was the lowly associate. So I just was like, this is not right. Like something about it just felt really wrong. And I went and I asked my boss and he's like, yeah, no, like that's not really cool. But like, you know, you're still pretty new. So I'm going to kind of like let him get away with it. And I just felt like it was very wrong. And so we ended up not like, for whatever reason, he ended up getting really mad at me because I had put my foot down about something and he made it a very hostile place to work. And I was like, this is happening again. Like, how is this? How could this be? Like, come on, third time's the charm, man. But by then I had built up enough distress tolerance to be like, okay, I'm going to get through this stressful situation, but I'm going to make this work for me and my benefit. At the time, COVID had happened. And so my husband got laid off and I was the only one working. So I was kind of in a bad spot too, where I was like, well, I can't quit my job because I'm the only one bringing in an income. But I also don't want to keep going on the way things are. And so we decided to move to a different state. And so I used that as an opportunity to negotiate a better situation for me. And so I negotiated where I said, like, look, allow me to continue working for you, but under these conditions. And so I was able to negotiate where I didn't have to do all of the work of that one other attorney anymore. I only had to work 20 hours a week. I was able to full-time parent my children while working part-time as an attorney. And now I live a very wonderful life where I get to homeschool my kids. I get to take care of them full-time, which is what I want. I still get to lawyer for 20 hours a week, but it's not in a way that makes me feel overwhelmed or stressed. It's just kind of fun for me at this point, and I really enjoy it, and I feel like I show up better for my clients, but it was through that learning how to deal with the distress and then finally learning how am I going to make this work for me in my favor, coming from being such a people pleaser to finally saying, how can I make things work better for myself without making other people suffer and putting other people in an inconvenient place? So I would say that because I was able to learn how to manage being very uncomfortable and feeling like I know I'm stuck, but I got to do something about this, I was able to work out a life that I didn't think was even possible.
That's so great to hear. And if nothing else, I want to go to the lawyer that enjoys their job, because surely they're doing a better job when they want to be there and they're not just, you know, counting down the minutes. So that's great to hear. And I have one more question before we wrap up around your industry, because I know something that is common is this mentality of, well, things were bad in my day. You know, I was treated like shit when I was at your level, and that's just the way it is. And it would surprise nobody to know, I don't really buy into that thinking. I think there are always things we can do to make the world a little bit nicer for each other.
Right.
And if you don't, it kind of feels like a sort of workplace generational trauma that you're passing down. Well, I was treated horribly, and therefore that justifies horrible behavior now, which it doesn't. And so is that something you've needed to cut? Yeah, go on. Tell me about your experience of that.
Yeah, I would say that definitely with the two high conflict bosses, I think that was a huge motivation. They were very harsh. And they just, well, and it was funny too, because like I did really good work. I mean, mm-hmm. I wasn't, and I don't know if like that kind of made them mad that I did good work, if it was like intimidating, but it was almost like they wanted to punish me for it because you can't be this good this fast. Or you like, you know, I'm going to make you do this because it's, you know, because I had to do it too. Or my boss treated me like this, so I can treat you like this. With the first boss, I just accepted it. I was like, okay. Like I wasn't even an attorney at that point. I was still an intern. With the second boss, I was an attorney. But by that point, especially with the whole laying boundaries down with her, I did say, I get it. You were treated like this. You don't need to treat me like this. And it clearly hurt you that you were treated like this. So why would you hurt me the same
way? Let's not perpetuate it. Yeah, but this is it. Yeah. It can be very normalized, these kind of behaviors. And I think that applies to so many workplaces. There's certain things. Mm-hmm. Like I remember a bank I worked in where we were expected to all be signed on and essentially like be booted up and ready to work 10 minutes before the start of our shift. And that's the way it had been for as long as anyone remembered. And then I was treated like I was wild of like, wait, so you're telling me I not only need to be here before the start of my shift, which I can understand, but I need to essentially start working 10 minutes early. And we were all just going along with this.
My husband's going through that right now. He's going through that exact thing right now. And he's like, this doesn't make sense. And everyone's like, oh, you're just young. You're just the young one. You gotta earn your keep. But it's silly. It's really silly because it doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. Well, because that's the thing. Some people will be like, oh, well, it's only 10 minutes. But it's 10 minutes every day and everyone's doing it. So like I'm sending an email 10 minutes before the start of my shift to somebody else who started their shift early. I don't know if it's changing lives. You know, we could just start when we're meant to start. I don't know who it's saving.
I agree.
Particularly in banking, I think there's a strong argument, are we saving lives at all? So
yeah, I think that for them, it must be like a principle of the thing kind of thing. But it's really silly. Yeah, I don't understand that way of thinking.
Yeah. So I think this is what we're getting to. We all have the right to question, the right to stand up for ourselves, and the right to get out, if that's also the best option. And so on that note, we'll wrap up. If people want to find your work.
Yes, controlledconfrontation.com. And then if they want to go to the resources that I mentioned, the argument playbook, the smear campaign survival guide, or the quiz to find out if they're in a high conflict relationship, then they can go to www.controlledconfrontation.com/resources.
Love a quiz. And thank you so much for this. It's been a great chat.
Thank you, Bobby. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.